reaction to former U.S. President Donald Trump's NATO comments draws quick global criticism.
Let's be serious. NATO cannot be a la carte military alliance.
U.S. President Joe Biden meets with Jordan's King Abdullah II at the White House.
Today, the King and I discussed with our senior foreign policy staffs what the issue that's front and center in the Middle East and well beyond.
And in Indonesia's presidential election, TikTok has become the second most used source of information.
As it seems nowadays, people prefer a happy campaign model, which includes dancing.
Today is Tuesday, February 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Donald Trump's claim that he once told a NATO ally that he would encourage Russia, quote, to do whatever the hell they want, unquote, to delinquent members of the group, sent shockwaves through Europe. Reaction was swift and triggered a rare rebuke from NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports from the State Department.
Speaking Saturday at a campaign rally in Conway, South Carolina, Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump veered from his prepared remarks to talk about his view that European countries are taking advantage of the United States and not paying their fair share for their security.
One of the presidents of a big country stood up and said, "Well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, will you protect us?" I said, "You didn't pay? You're delinquent?" He said, "Yes, let's say that happened. No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay. You got to pay your bills."
Trump's apparent fondness for Russian President Vladimir Putin and distrust of NATO allies are not new. But this comment, encouraging Moscow to attack a NATO ally, triggered a more-than-normal slew of European reactions. In a statement, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said, "Any suggestion that allies will not defend each other undermines all of our security, including that of the U.S., and puts American and European soldiers at increased risk." European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell said this.
"Let's be serious. NATO cannot be an alliance à la carte. It exists or it not exists. But I'm not going to spend my time comment any silly idea that comes during this electoral campaign in the U.S.
No country has debts to NATO, as Trump suggests. In 2014, alliance allies pledged to move towards spending 2% of their gross domestic product on defense by 2024. NATO estimates that, as of early 2023, 10 of its 30 member states were close to that 2% mark. One expert noted that Trump has also asked the Republican-led House of Representatives not to provide any more U.S. military aid for Ukraine, which is fighting a defensive war against Russia. Michael Kimmage is a professor of history with the Catholic University of America. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
American policy is to some degree already shifting because there's a candidate Trump and because Trump is the leader of the Republican Party. I think that these comments are in a way the icing on the cake and suggest that depending on how the election goes, Europe could in some ways be alone with Russia and Europe could be significantly more alone with the war in Ukraine.
Another expert told VOA that Congress has put some policies in place to protect the NATO alliance, which has guaranteed security in Europe since the end of World War II. Lindsay Newman is head of Eurasia Group's Global Macro Geopolitics Practice. She spoke to VOA via Zoom.
And in fact, in 2023, as part of the National Defense Authorization Act, Congress actually passed a requirement that the president, any president, couldn't unilaterally withdraw from NATO without congressional approval.
But other experts say a future president would have other ways of weakening NATO short of a formal withdrawal, including by pulling U.S. troops out of Germany or by casting doubts on America's treaty obligation to honor Article 5, NATO's Mutual Defense Clause. Under the clause, all NATO allies commit to help any member who comes under attack. The article has only been activated once, by the United States, in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Trump's language is misleading about how NATO works. There are no bills to be paid. NATO members don't pay subscription fees and do not owe the alliance money for defense. What he's actually referring to is a vague commitment NATO countries made in 2006 and formalized in 2014 to spend 2% of their gross domestic product on their own defense. Joining us now to talk about this is Jesse Driscoll. He's an associate professor of political science and serves as chair of the Global Leadership Institute at the University of California, San Diego. Let's start with what this NATO commitment actually is.
Sure. So the main thing to understand is that there is a defense investment guideline, which all NATO member states have agreed to, which is typically benchmarked at 2%. And you can take this back to 2006, but it's the sort of thing that gets ceremonially agreed to every year. And since the most recent full-scale invasion of Ukraine, it has certainly been reiterated by all of the allies that 2% of GDP will be spent on defense. The idea is that there's recognition that there have been shortfalls in the past, but now in the future going forward, everyone in the alliance is going to pay 2% so that it's not the United States picking up the slack for European countries subsidizing their welfare states, but not actually investing in their own defense and security. That's the criticism.
And to that point, to be fair, he's not wrong. There are countries, big countries like Germany, which is the most robust economy in Europe, that does not spend 2% of their GDP on defense.
Yes, that is correct. And I think that he's also, if we're going to be fair, channeling the frustration of a lot of people who have watched Europeans essentially sit by and watch the United States draw down its entire stock of 155 artillery munition, giving it to Ukraine and missing key decision points that might have been not blown through that would have allowed more burden sharing within the alliance. The reason that the alliance uses standard interoperable weapons is precisely so that it's not necessarily the United States' munition that is being used in any NATO war. It could be French. It could be anyone's. And some of these countries do have, in principle, large defense industrial bases that could have been put to work keeping Ukraine resupplied. And so, the issue, the underlying issue here is that there is an expensive war in Europe. And a lot of people in the Republican Party are frustrated that our European allies are not spending more aggressively to enable Ukrainian resilience. Now, they're doing a lot of other things, and I don't think the criticism is entirely fair, as stated, but I think that's the heart of the frustration and the criticism.
Well, it's also a mindset of, you know, isolationism, but that's another story. The thing that really triggered this latest round of angst was his comments that if you're not spending 2% of your GDP on defense and you get attacked by Russia, I'm not coming to your aid.
Yes, and of course, that's the kind of inflammatory statement that forced a strong response, an institutional response that now he gets to run against is the frustration on the part of not only our soldiers and sailors who feel that he's making American defense commitments less credible in the future and undermining American deterrence, which puts all of us at risk. But more than that, it's really disrespectful to and shows a deep misunderstanding of the alliance structures that are the centerpiece of American grand strategy. And the national security strategy is quite clearly states that our allies and partners are the center of gravity for American national security in the future. Trump behaves as if that is not true, but it is true, and it will remain true.
And just to sort of explain why not coming to the aid of a NATO ally is problematic.
NATO is a mutual defense alliance. The nature of the alliance is that you will have Article 4 and Article 4 and 5 consultations if any member is attacked. And the sacredness of the pledge, the idea that Biden is capable of saying and making it credible that we will defend every inch of NATO territory, depends on a belief that the United States and other NATO allies will actually do that. I mean, recall that when the United States was attacked on September 11th, NATO consulted and said a NATO member has been attacked, and then NATO went into Afghanistan. It wasn't the United States going in alone. We were attacked, and a lot of people say that was NATO's finest hour.
Jesse Driscoll, chair of the Global Leadership Institute at the University of California, San Diego. President Biden has welcomed Jordan's King Abdullah to the White House for talks on how to end the months-long war in Gaza and plan for what comes afterward.
As the King and I discussed today, the United States is working on a hostage deal between Israel and Hamas, which would bring an immediate and sustained period of calm to Gaza for at least 6 weeks, which we could then take the time to build something more enduring.
Taking the lectern after Biden spoke, Abdullah renewed his appeal for a broad ceasefire.
The situation is already unbearable for over 1 million people who have been pushed into Rafah since the war started. We cannot stand by and let this continue. We need a lasting ceasefire now. This war must end.
Before embarking on a tour of Western capitals, Abdullah participated in an airdrop of humanitarian aid to Gaza, a move that highlighted his kingdom's role in pushing Israel to stop restricting efforts to fend off illness, hunger, and starvation in the Strip. Hamas is a U.S.-designated terrorist group. Following these other stories from around the world, the United States called Monday for respect of freedom of assembly as Pakistani authorities warned they'd ban protests by supporters of jailed former Prime Minister Imran Khan after his bloc's shock election triumph. However, because they're designated as independents, they can't form a government, raising fears of prolonged political uncertainty. Video has emerged of a meeting between Brazil's then-president, Jair Bolsonaro, and his cabinet urging action in the face of a potential victory by his challenger, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, in the 2022 presidential election. The video was released by Brazil's Supreme Court, recorded months before that election. A Canadian-Russian woman on Monday pleaded guilty in a U.S. court to money laundering conspiracy for her role in a multi-million-dollar scheme to send drone and missile components to Russia for military use against Ukraine. The U.S. Justice Department said she laundered money on behalf of several Brooklyn front companies to ship U.S. origin electronics to sanctioned entities in Russia. A new bill allowing authorities to confiscate the property of Russians convicted of deliberately spreading what is deemed as fake news about Russia's armed forces could soon become law. If signed into law, it would also allow the state to seize the property of Russian immigrants who criticize the war in Ukraine. Katarina Besedina has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is expected to sign into law a bill that would allow the government to confiscate the property of people whom it convicts of deliberately spreading false news about Russia's military.
законопроекта о негодяях и предателях.
Вячеслав Володин, chairman of Russia's State Duma, says the law will punish scoundrels and traitors who have betrayed Mother Russia and are living abroad and receiving revenue by renting out their property. Other offenses that could lead to asset confiscation include failing to comply with an order, deserting the military, calling for sanctions to be imposed on Russia, and participating in the activities of an undesirable organization. Russian opposition leader Dmitry Gudkov says the law can be interpreted however the government wants. He says it was passed to make sure people are afraid to rally, afraid to vote for anyone but Putin, or protest Putin's rule. Former Duma deputy and opposition leader Dmitry Gudkov is now a wanted man in Russia for criticizing Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Gudkov, who has not lived in the country for several years, says he got rid of his property in Russia, but other anti-government-minded people were not so lucky. He says when the war started, many people who disagreed with the authorities and disapproved of the war left the country. And obviously, many of them haven't had time to sell their property in Russia, and they are the ones who'll be targeted. According to OVD Info, an independent Russian human rights media project, about 830 people have had cases brought against them for their anti-war position in Russia. About one-third of these cases involve charges of spreading false information about the army. John Herbst, senior director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, says the measure is just an attempt to hide the truth about Russia's war crimes.
The Russian government wants to project a myth about the Russian army's activities in Ukraine. They want to deny the war crimes. They want to hide the failures. And so they will punish people who break those myths.
Andrew Wood, an expert on Russian policy at London-based Chatham House, says it's important that the authorities create an illusion of mass support for Putin.
Opinion in Russia of the futile achievements that they have from the war and the reasons that it started, like complaints of people who have relatives or husbands or whatever at the front against what is being done, it's increased. And I think that Putin himself is a bit more conscious of the fact that his hold is not as big as it has been on the Russian population.
Experts like Herbst and Wood say mass property confiscation is unlikely, but they expect the government to target individuals who criticize the war. For Katerina Besedina in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. More than 100 million people are expected to vote in Indonesia's presidential election on Wednesday. Indonesia is a vibrant democracy, but some fear it's sliding back to a past that wasn't democratic at all. One reason they think this is possible is because many young people don't know much about that history. And as this vote approaches, candidates have gravitated toward TikTok as they try to reach those young voters. It's a platform that has become the country's second most used source of information on politics, after television, according to a pollster. But it's a platform that experts say also comes with issues. Here's Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn.
These Indonesian women are trying to promote presidential candidate Prabowo Subianto on TikTok. It's a platform all three candidates have gravitated towards as they try to reach the country's millions of young voters ahead of the February 14th election. TikTok has 125 million users in Indonesia and has become the country's second most used source of information on politics after television, according to pollster Indicator Politik Indonesia. Fauzan Habib is a social media campaigner for Subianto.
The cute dance is quite viral because it was introduced and even done by Mr. Prabowo himself. And it turns out that the public loves it. As it seems nowadays, people prefer a happy campaign model, which includes dancing.
Subianto's rivals, Anies Baswedan and Ganjar Pranowo, have also ramped up their presence on the app, answering questions during live streams or sharing videos of heartfelt encounters with voters. But experts say TikTok is also flooded with problematic content that attempts to manipulate young voters. Enda Truastuti is a communications researcher at the University of Indonesia. She says many young voters may not be aware that Subianto has been forced to deny allegations of human rights abuses during his time as Special Forces Commander.
Youth who are targets of this rebranding do not have a grasp of the historical and political context within Prabowo's political ecosystem. This is consistent with narratives on TikTok, such as, if he did violate human rights, why was he never jailed?
Manipulated images and deepfake videos of the candidates have also circulated widely. TikTok says on its website its policy is to remove harmful misinformation and work with fact-checkers to flag or debunk it. Political ads and fundraising are banned. Nearly 205 million people are registered to vote as the world's third largest democracy heads to the polls on Wednesday.
Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At a recent UN Security Council briefing on threats to international peace and security, cynically called by Russia, UN Undersecretary General for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs, Rosemary DiCarlo, said that since February 2022, the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has reported 30,041 civilian casualties in Ukraine, with 10,382 killed, including 579 children. She noted that the number of civilian casualties significantly increased in December and January. Robert Wood, U.S. Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs, said the United States laments all civilian casualties and expresses its sincerest condolences to the families of any civilians killed.
Though there is much we don't know, we do know this. The Kremlin bears full responsibility for the unconscionable death and destruction brought about as a consequence of Putin's war of aggression against Ukraine in violation of the UN Charter. Russian forces invaded a peaceful neighbor and continue their relentless attacks against Ukraine.
Ambassador Wood noted that investigators associated with the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine and the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine continue their heroic efforts to document and investigate all alleged violations and abuses of human rights near the front lines and in formerly occupied areas.
This reporting has painted a brutal, blood-soaked image of civilian suffering and unspeakable atrocities committed by Russian forces in Bucha and many other places.
We must remember, said Ambassador Wood, that Russia alone started this war, and its aggression against Ukraine is a blatant violation of the UN Charter and of Ukraine's territorial integrity.
Even as we sit here, Russia continues to flout international law as it doubles down on its violations of the UN arms embargo on the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Russia and the DPRK must be held accountable for their actions, which undermine long-standing obligations under UN Security Council resolutions.
Russia, said Ambassador Wood, is the only aggressor in this war and the only one that could end this war today. The United States, he declared, renews our calls for Russia to immediately withdraw its forces from Ukraine's internationally recognized borders, cease its unlawful procurement of arms and materiel from the DPRK, and meet its responsibilities as a member of this council.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.